Just like to say good morning, Boston. My name is Christine Fandozzi. On behalf of Merck & Company, a corporate sponsor for the Massachusetts Conference for Women, I want to just say good morning and welcome you all here to the session. It's going to be a great session. Merck is a company that very much supports the advancement of women. We support the conference here in Massachusetts, as well as in Pennsylvania, California, and Texas. So very happy to be here with you today. Merck also supports the advancement of women through things like partnering with the Simmons College to do advanced executive education, as well as recognition by Working Mother magazine as one of the best places to work for working moms. So I hope throughout the day today you will enjoy the conference, pick up some practical skills that will enable you to be the best versions of yourself. So I hope you have a great day. This session is Tackling Life's Curveballs with a Financial Plan and Some Sanity. This will be an amazing hour with Jean Chatsky and Kathy Murphy. Jean is the financial editor of NBC's Today Show and is the renowned best-selling author. Her latest book titled Age Proof, Living Longer Without Running Out of Money or Breaking a Hip. She also does amazing philanthropy work, helping to educate women and children with their finances. I'd also like to introduce Kathy Murphy. Kathy is the president of Fidelity Investments, with more than 19 million clients and accounts valued at over, and I don't get to say this word very often, $2.4 trillion. Kathy is recognized multiple years by Fortune magazine as one of the top 50 most powerful women. She's also recognized by Wall Street as the top 50. Prior to Fidelity, Kathy was CEO of ING U.S. Wealth Management and began her career at Aetna. She holds a bachelor's in economics and political science from Fairfield University and a JD with the highest honors from the University of Connecticut. So without further ado, please put your hands together and welcome Jean Chatsky and Kathy Murphy.
Dean. Wow, what a room. This is incredible. Good morning, everybody. I am so excited to see so many women and a few men here. We won't hold it against you. Here to talk about money. This is fabulous. So this is how we are going to play this. I've got a bunch of questions that I'm going to tee up for Kathy. We'll bat them back and forth for a little while. And then we really want to take your questions because we know money is personal. We know it is important. We know there is a reason that you chose to be in this room. So gather your questions, get them ready. We will leave plenty of time to answer them. What is remarkable to me, and I know to you, Kathy, is that over the past few decades, women have come so far in so many ways, right? When we look at college graduation rates, grad school graduation rates, the number of women who are starting businesses, women are way ahead of where men are. Yet when it comes to investing our money, we're not quite there yet, especially when it comes to confidence about investing our money. It is time for that to change. And so that is where I want to start. You are a confident investor, and Christine gave us a few details about your bio, but tell everybody how you got here so they know who we're dealing with.
All right, so first of all, I didn't start as a confident investor. I didn't even actually think I would ever be in financial services, by the way. But I'm one of six kids. I'm the third of six kids. And so just a couple of basic facts about my upbringing. We didn't have a lot of money, but my parents did emphasize the importance of working hard and saving. So by the age of 10, I was babysitting, maybe to get out of the house a little bit too. And each of us, we either, you know, mowing lawns, babysitting, whatever it was. And then we were marched down to the local bank. Remember, there were actually, you were marched down to the local bank and you had your passbook. I know I'm dating myself. And so it was important to save money. But we never, ever talked about investing. And in fact, my mom and dad had the very traditional division of labor, which is my mom paid the bills and my dad did the investing to the extent we had money to invest. And by the way, we'll get to this later probably, that traditional division of labor persists way too much today, 40, 50 years later. But fast forward, my dad died unexpectedly of a massive heart attack when he was 57. My mom was 54. She's a nurse. And that really rocked our world. We still had three of the kids in college. My mom was at sea. She had no idea, you know, how the money was invested, how to move forward, how to get three kids through college, how is she going to ever retire? And that really, that was very, very impactful. And I, by that point, I was just starting out as a lawyer at Aetna in the healthcare division. But over time, found my way to the financial services division in part based on seeing what my mom went through.
You know, it's interesting. I experienced a similar upbringing. Only half as many kids. I'm a family of three, but it felt like a lot. And I don't know if it was just the time, but we were similar too. I mean, my father was a college professor. There was not a ton of money. I too was babysitting, not at 10, at 11. At 11, so you've got me beat. But worked all the way through high school, saved all the way through high school into college, and yet when I got out of college, found myself completely at a loss when it came to my personal finances and made a ton yes. of mistakes as I was getting started, racking up credit card debt, botching my first attempt at a 401k. I was actually one of those people who pulled the money out of the 401k.
Don't do it.
Yes. I did it when I switched jobs for the very first time. I didn't understand what I had, and so I got a check in the mail and went shopping, and I was very excited, I gotta say.
So I have to tell you, I did one of those things too. It was such a move driven by ego. And that is that I really, really, really wanted to buy a house before I was married, to say I did it on my own. So I took a loan out of my 401k to buy a house. It was so stupid, and it wasn't even a good house. I ended up losing money on that house, but it was... Well, and it took me 10 years to pay that loan back.
So taking a loan out of a 401k, cashing out of 401ks, I mean, these are classic investment mistakes.
Yes.
One of the things that you do in your day-to-day job is oversee 20 million retirement accounts, more than anybody else. What are the mistakes that you see people making now?
Yeah, so we'll focus on women.
Women.
But it's not sort of gender specific. I'll give three examples across different categories. We see too many young people, you know, Jean in her past life, that put off taking the first step of investing in your 401k, your 403b at a minimum to get started. The powerful impact of saving even a little bit when you're young is so important as you get to be older, the compound effect of that, it's called. So I listen to about 20 hours of customer calls every single month as I'm driving to and from work, and it's so heartening when I hear this phone call, which I hear often enough. My dad told me to, I just started my job, my first job, and my dad told me to call to sign up for the 401k. I'm like, yes. And it's not a long call because it's not that hard to say what you should do when you're first starting out and you don't have much complexity in your life. So one category is if you're young, take the steps to get started. And also think about how much you should invest and then how to pay off debt. So that's one category for younger people. Second category is women as they get older. And Jean and I have talked about this a lot over the years. We find so many women that aren't engaged enough if they're part of a partnership, meaning they have a spouse or a partner, in knowing what to do. So they defer to the spouse or the partner, generally a man, and they get to their like 40s or 50s and they have no idea whether how they're invested, whether they're comfortable with it. So knowledge is the second thing. And then the third and most important, and Gene started off the session with this, is the difference between saving and investing. Women actually are pretty good, better than men, at saving money, even though we also do 80% of the purchasing in our households. But there's a clear confidence gap that in terms of women taking the step from saving the money to actually investing it. And if you're simply saving the money and not investing it in some way, you're actually losing money. A little bit. And so it is important for women, and this is something Gene and I travel a country sometimes together, to talk about how important it is to just take the basic steps to invest your money.
I think there's investing your money, and then there's owning that you're investing your money. Can I just see hands? How many of you have a retirement account? And how many of you, leave them up. How many of you would say you're investors? Yeah, it's like a third. So what is that?
Okay, so we did some research recently, and 65% of women equate investing with picking individual stocks. And I see so many heads nodding. That is a form of investing, but it's not the only form. Investing is not hard. The financial services industry can make it seem a lot harder and intimidating than it actually is, and that's something we're trying to change. But the process of investing is actually some basic fundamentals of just how much risk you want to take and how to choose an investment mix. And you can pay an advisor to help you with that. You can use simple products where it does it sort of automatically. The point is to just learn the basics. And by the way, I'm not picking on men out there, but we have shown in our company, we've got millions and millions of customers, that on average, women do slightly better than men when they do take the step of investing. So when we do it, we're really good at it.
And the reason that we're so good at it is because we don't meddle, right? It's because we don't try to time the market, because we don't try always to pick individual stocks. The hot stocks when we don't have to. I mean, it's interesting. Everybody who had their hands up with the retirement account, you are investors. Trying to time the market might make you a bad investor. So don't feel terrible about that.
Yeah, sometimes I cheekily say that women focus on long-term performance and men focus on short-term performance. And long-term performance wins out.
Yeah, all the time. You talked a little bit about changing the industry. There was a recent story in the Dallas Morning News, big newspaper in Texas, and it started with this statement. Kathleen Murphy is fed up with the investment world being created by men in the image of men at the expense of women. Yeah. Explain.
So again, this
Right? That's amazing.
And this is really not anti-men. You know, the financial services industry, you know, kudos to men, the men that were involved in creating lots of good things about financial services. If you don't have diversity of thought, then you tend to create things in your own image. And if women left to their own devices, would do the same thing, right? We just didn't happen to be at the scene. And so for years, the financial services industry, the way we talked, how the products were developed, how the experiences evolved, were really more from a man's point of view. And that's no one's fault. That's just the way it happened. But the problem is, when we talk about things like alpha and beta and quant and all that stuff, it's really a turnoff. And so as we've done, stepped back and said, the research of, you know, that old movie, What Do Women Really Want? They want an experience that's more holistic, that thinks about long-term goals, that's about their family's goals, if they have a family. If you're single, it's about how do I make this money last in a different way than how it's portrayed in so many different companies. And so, when we ask women what do they want an approach that is engaging, that where it's approachable, where it's warm, where you talk about long-term goals and not things like performance and particular stocks and all that. And so I think it's really, really important, particularly because we're in the midst of a $22 trillion shift in assets to women. Because women will outlive men on average by 5 to 7 years, because the divorce rate is 50%, and because so many women aren't getting married. For all those reasons, women will control a ton of money, trillions of tons of money. And so it's really important for the industry to step up to that challenge and say, how do we do a better job?
And how do we do a better job at times when life just happens, right? I mean, I talk a lot. I have a podcast called Her Money. I hope you're all listening to Her Money.
It's great.
But if you're not, subscribe and tune in. And I talk a lot on my podcast about how we often don't come for financial advice just because. We come for financial advice because something happens, because we get married, because we get divorced, because we have a baby, because we get a job, because we lose a job, because our parents are older and they need care. I mean, Fidelity and Stanford actually did some amazing research where they said, on average, 4 times every single year, we're going to go through some major life transition. And some of them are good and some of them are bad, but it's going to happen 4 times every single year. How do you manage your financial life knowing that you don't know what's coming around the next corner?
You know, every person is unique. But we also can see commonalities among groups of people. And so there is a lot that you can, when you talk to somebody, and you don't have to pay money for this, you can get free information, you can engage digitally, you can pay an advisor or not, we can talk about that. But a lot of what happens is either life stage based or based on events that happen to many people, unfortunately. So life stages, as Gene said, getting married, having a baby, whatever. Life events like divorce, like aging parents.
Well, for you in your own life, what's the biggest curveball that you've experienced?
So I would say the biggest curveball was my dad dying. That was like, whoa. It was a wake-up call and seeing what my mother went through and what people of her age go through in your 50s and you're at sea and you don't have much time left in terms of working and wow. And then it sort of the reflection of, all right, what do I have to do to prevent that from happening to me? And now, by the way, my mom, you know, 30 years later has Alzheimer's. And so you see the issue of the aging parent, et cetera. But at that time, Gene, one of the things I did to try and get ahead of that, I made another mistake, which was I did go to a financial advisor that was recommended by somebody, and both paid fees I probably shouldn't have and bought some products that I shouldn't have that made him a lot of money. So I was trying to do the right thing, but it's really important in terms of that is to really understand what you're paying for and why. And again, what the comfort for all of you is that what you're going through, a lot of other people either have gone through or are going through, and there's sort of objective ways to help you without having you being taken advantage of.
Yeah, I think that's true no matter what life throws at you.
What's your curveball?
Well, so when I turned 40, which was not pleasant in and of itself.
It beats turning 50. I suppose there's another way to look at that.
No, that's okay. I actually liked 50 a lot better than I liked 40, but I didn't like 40 because I was getting divorced and my dad died, like within a 3-month period.
And
I found financially, I started over, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I had I had money in a 401k, which I was very, very fortunate to have, but I moved out of the family house because it was too big for me to handle, and bought something else, and started saving for college for my kids all over again, started envisioning life all over again. That was a very big curveball. I mean, there are others. I mean, you could just list them. I've been fired. I've started a business. I feel like I'm like a little petri dish for personal finance.
So in those sort of various pivots, how did you stay the course in terms of, you know, because now you're this, you know, national expert. So how did you do it?
I followed my own advice, actually. So I all along the way, I people are sometimes surprised to hear that I have a financial advisor, and I've never heard you say you've had one before, but we need financial advisors because you need somebody else keeping an eye on the money at many stages of your life. Not always, but I got help.
Yep.
And I also started saving money like a crazy person.
Yes.
And particularly when I got divorced, spending on a big house, and that didn't make me feel comfortable, but having money saved, having money put away, and then putting that money to work and investing it, and actually visiting my investment accounts once a month. I still do this. Once a month, I'll go on like a little guided tour on my computer of here's the 529, and here's the 401k, and here is the savings account, just because it makes me feel better to see that my savings are growing and my investments are growing.
Yeah. So in terms of the, Gene's right, you know, it's important to have an advisor, particularly as your life gets more complex, if you're not comfortable doing it yourself. I would say that it's also really important to know who to trust when you're choosing that advisor. And so I remember being at a event like this in San Francisco, and these two young women came up to me and were trying to get their arms around this, and so they hired an advisor, and you know, and they didn't know how much they were paying the advisor. They were trying to do all the right things, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you don't need to pay somebody based on what's going on in your life. There's a lot of things that are available to you. You can call somebody and get started in the right way without having to pay them to buy a target date fund, for example, if you're just starting out. And then if you do need an advisor, you know what? Feel comfortable asking them what they make and how. You do it when you buy a car. And this is a lot more important than buying a car.
Yep.
And so many people feel uncomfortable with that conversation. And check them out on there's a thing called FINRA, it's a financial regulator. They have a thing called Broker Check where you can see if there's any complaints against that broker. They don't have it for investment advisors, unfortunately, but you can. It's easy to check out Broker Check and make sure that whoever you're dealing with doesn't have a lot of complaints against them from other customers.
So can you get a little more granular with that? Because I got to say, when I go out and I speak, how do I find an advisor I can trust is the number one question that I get asked. So, A, when do you and don't you need one? And then if you do need one, how do you find one?
So first of all, if you're investing in your 401k, really, or 403b, really make sure you're maxing out on that. If you still have money left over, that's great. And you should look for, if you're young and single, there's ways you can invest any extra money without paying a lot of fees, because it's your life is generally speaking not that complicated. Even if you want to balance reducing debt with investing, you can get access to information without paying. So that's one. So that, you know, don't pay if you don't really need quote advice, because life's not complicated. When life starts to get more complicated, we often see people come in when they've had their first baby. They're in their 30s or even older, and they start to have a little more money, They now have, they clearly can invest more than in their 401k and 403b, and how do I do it? If there's any question that you're not a do-it-yourself investor, you probably should be talking to somebody. And there's not, and actually there's probably less than 20% of the population that are really do-it-yourself investors. So most people do need help. And then in terms of who can you trust, while getting a referral from family and friends is important, just, you know, like I know in my family, they'll make referrals, but do they know any more than I do about who they're referring me to? Do a little due diligence, because don't assume your family and friends are actually gurus in investing either. And again, you know, so, and I keep coming back to those two basic questions. When you ultimately look, if an advisor is squirming when you ask them how much, what they're making and how much and how, you know, and on what basis, or if they're squirming when they talk to you about products and they don't want to tell you the commission they're making, be skeptical.
I also think it's really important to pay attention when you're having a first conversation with an advisor to who's doing the talking.
Yes.
You know, if they are doing 70% of the talking and you are sitting there with your mouth shut for most of the time, I would walk away.
Here's another one to walk away. If you're married and they direct the entire conversation to your husband, because once women become widowed, 70% of them change their advisor because they felt patronized or ignored while they were working with that advisor.
Yeah. You mentioned the issue of trade-offs, talking about debt versus investing. So many people, how many people are still dealing with student loans? Yeah, a good number, and our children will have them as well, probably more. But there often comes a time in life where you're wondering, should I do this or
yes.
that? Should I invest more or pay off my student loans? Should I pay off the mortgage or invest? How do you deal with these either ors?
Yeah, so let's talk about two either ors. One either or is, do I pay off the student debt or save more or invest more? And it's actually reduces to a math question. If the interest rate on those loans is high, you should pay them off really quickly because it's just money that's going right out the door. In this low interest rate environment that we've been in for a decade now, a lot of student loans are actually very low interest rate. And so it's probably, you know, paying them off on a gradual basis probably makes more sense. Your credit card debt is bad. It's bad, bad, bad. And so, first of all, get rid of it as soon as you can and don't contribute to it going forward. Pay your credit card bill. The guiding posts are no credit card debt if possible, you know, over time, and really maximize the 401k, 403b contributions because that will pay dividends. And your employer often helps give, you know, pay for your 401k, so it's free money. Never leave free money on the table, ever. Okay. Second big trade-off is I now have a child and I want to, you know, starting early, I want to help create a college fund for them. How much do I save for my retirement versus their college? And we interviewed lots of employees at different companies that we do business with. And I remember this one fellow on video said, you know, you can't get a loan for your retirement. You can get a loan for your college education, but you can't get a loan for your retirement. And so one of the guiding principles, even though it's emotionally hard, is to say, let's make sure I'm staying on task in terms of those retirement goals, and then figure out how much I can save for that college fund. But don't go so far in saving for the 529 that you sort of ignore the retirement goals.
Well, the problem with ignoring the retirement goals, and I acknowledge this, it's a really hard trade-off, right? Because as parents, we want to do something for our kids as well. The problem is, if we shortchange ourselves, we're going to get to the point where we're trying to retire and they're trying to put their own kids through college and they're going to have to help us.
Right. That sandwich generation, yeah, it becomes, yeah.
Sandwich generation math is not a lot of fun. I am going to open it up for questions in just a couple of minutes, but I do want to come back to some of those specific life events and advice for people who are going through them. So I mentioned I went through a divorce. What do you tell the women that you are hearing from who are thinking, I am headed in that direction?
Yeah, so in a divorce, which is highly emotional often, you need to have, I'd say, two flavors of advisors around you to make sure you are thinking objectively or they are on your behalf. One is somebody with a financial background that can make sure that you navigate sort of the complexities of, do I get Social Security benefits from my spouse? Am I doing the right things from a tax perspective? What about my credit history based on, you know, the spouses? And then the other advisor you need is a lawyer. And you don't have to pay a ton of money for a lawyer, but you do need a lawyer to make sure, again, in a very emotional time, someone's thinking really objectively and practically and can represent your best interests.
You need a third advisor. You need a shrink.
Well, yeah, okay.
Just saying. Yeah. And Kathy has been happily married, and I'm happily married again for the second time, but Kathy's been happily married for, what, 25 years?
29.
Yeah. Amazing. So, all right, so flip it around. Yeah, okay, great. Make me feel bad.
So can I talk about one other big life event?
Yes.
Close to home for me is aging parents. There's three categories of that. One is aging parents that that are well positioned to take care of themselves financially, but may need your help in other ways. But there's too often mental decline in Alzheimer's, and then the third category is when again a spouse dies, and the elderly parent is left alone and is easily the target of fraud and elderly abuse. So let me talk about a couple categories here. In all three cases, you ought to be having a conversation with your older parents about ahead of time about power of attorney. So healthcare proxy, being able to take over financial matters if you need to. It's so much easier to have that conversation before there's a decline. Once there starts to be a decline, I can tell you very personally, it gets very defensive. They don't want to acknowledge that they're sort of losing ground, and it becomes much tougher. So do get the healthcare proxy, the power of attorney. Make sure you're having those conversations ahead of time before it gets emotional. The other thing is we see way too often, that even if the mental capacity has not declined, the elderly who become lonely are really subject to all sorts of financial and other abuse. And so make sure, you're checking in on your parents in terms of, you know, how they're spending money, who they're spending time with. It's very sad.
Yeah. Yeah, and while you are making sure that your parents have all of that documentation, we should be doing it for ourselves,
yes.
Especially single women.
Yes, right? Yes.
I mean, we sometimes think that these things go hand in hand with getting married, that I don't need a will, I don't need life insurance. But as a single woman, you have
absolutely
very, very specific needs. All right, we've got microphones here. One, two, three. If there are any questions, please join us, and we would love to take them. I see one coming right here.
Yeah, sorry. Just going to lay this out on the table, I guess. But you mentioned at the beginning the big mistake of taking a loan out of the 401k. My husband and I have been meeting with financial advisors, and they've told us that for a first-time home purchase, we can save money by taking a loan out and then avoiding mortgage insurance. Is there what would you advise on that? Really appreciate guidance.
So, you know, you have to go through the specifics for your situation. I think it's really important to understand the ramifications of taking out that loan. And so you have to do the math going backwards of if you didn't take out that loan, how much money would you get from saving, you know, investing that money plus the employer contribution over time. So there's you have to do the math over a long period of time versus that mortgage interest and how long you would have the mortgage and not pay. So there's a math it's the discipline of saying over the life of that investment, both the mortgage interest and the compound effect of leaving employer money on the table plus the impact of not having that investment grow, what's the better math answer?
And sometimes I know financial advisors like to talk about when you take a loan out of a 401k, the interest rate is fairly low and you're paying the money, the interest back to yourself. But they're not taking into consideration what Kathy just said, which is that you are losing those years of growth in the market. And if it happened to be the last 5 years, that could have been really, really devastating.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the thing to pay attention to and also to look at. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so the other thing is, if your financial advisor is attached to a bank, make sure, ask them if they're getting compensated in any way for providing that mortgage.
Okay.
Hi. My question is about tax planning. Sorry.
Yes.
Just speak up a little bit.
My question is about actually tax planning.
Yeah.
And I do my own investing and.
Good. Excellent.
Thank you. But I'm really lost and becoming more acutely aware of the importance of good tax management and tax planning. What is your advice for finding an advisor who can help me and my husband sort of the intersection between tax advice and investment advice?
So there are some firms that do both. The other thing you could do is go to a CPA. And if you are comfortable as an investor matching that with the knowledge of the certified, you know, public accountant that can put those two things together. But there are some firms that do both, but there's not many that do full tax planning and investing. But the CPA, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and you can actually do a Google search too, or a search at the Financial Planning Association website, and you can. There are financial advisors who are also CPAs. They may cost a little more because they got more letters after their names, but they do exist. The other thing I would say is that my financial advisor actually recommended my accountant.
Yeah, there you go.
And they talk to each other. So if you can get a team that actually will communicate with each other, that can help you do the necessary tax planning as well.
I just feel like that's where we can go really wrong really fast.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Hi. So if we've weighed that we are able to save for our children's education, what do you think about going a 529 plan where you really have to spend that money on education, not knowing what's my child going to be like in 18 years, versus going through a brokerage account where you're saving, but the money could be spent on something that's not education, but you don't have the benefits of a 529 plan?
Sure, I'll start. One of the nice things about 529s is if you have more than one child, you can actually move the money to the account for the other child. You can also use it yourself. In the last year or so, you've gotten the ability to use it for K through 12 education as well. And so it is a little bit more flexible than we sometimes think it is. But I totally get what you're saying. And if you're cautious about that, I would say put some money in a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. Because you can use Roth funds, and they get very, very similar tax benefits. You can use Roth funds for either education or for retirement down the road.
I think the benefit of both of those is their tax advantage. And that's what you really want to get if you can.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. This is a question about selecting a financial advisor, which you touched on earlier. So you said pay attention to how they get compensated. Can you talk about specifically what are the different business models? How are advisors compensated? How do you find out? And what are the pros and cons of the different models?
Okay. And Jean, chime in here at any point. So so some advisors, they're called usually called registered investment advisors, get paid based a percentage based on the assets you invest because they're advising you on those funds. Okay, so it's a basically a percent of whatever you give them to invest for you. Second category is a broker who gets paid based on the specific products they provide to you. And so it's at a specific point in time as opposed to that ongoing fee. And then there's a third category where there's companies that have a mixture. My company's one of them that based on what you need, we develop the plan for either of those things. So there's a hybrid of, approach as well. I'd say it does come back. Which model to choose really is dependent on what your needs are. So, for example, as I mentioned, somebody just starting out that doesn't have a lot of complexity in their life, that it's pretty clear what they should do, like a target date fund, you shouldn't pay an ongoing fee to an advisor for something like a target date fund, which is basically you take your assets and you put, based on your age, you figure out how much risk there is and you put some in the stock. There's a fund that you don't have to do anything. You buy the fund that's already allocated to match your risk profile. So so you shouldn't pay an advisor an ongoing fee for that. If you're older and you want advice across your entire portfolio of investments, that might be worth it. But always ask, what's the percentage that they're getting paid for helping you? And make sure you're comfortable with that amount of money. Don't just find out the percent. Do the math to say, how much money is that a year? And then you can evaluate. Anything else?
No, I think that's right. I mean, the I don't know where you went, but Oh, there you are. The other thing about financial advisors is that over the last 5 or so years, they're willing to work in very different ways. So if you just want to see a financial advisor one time, you can pay somebody by the hour. And there are some that charge a monthly subscription. And so there are a lot of different permutations now, which just enables people to find something that they're a little bit more comfortable with.
The only thing I would say is there's so much information online now, not just about the advisors themselves, but about what you're thinking about in terms of how much risk do I want to take? What are the things I'm comfortable with or not? So I would encourage everyone, before you go to an advisor, arm yourself with information and knowledge so you can have a more informed conversation where you can start to judge whether you're comfortable with this person's approach.
Hi. I have a question relating to an aging parent. Yep. So my mother is my only surviving parent, 73, just starting to enter retirement, is completely and wholly unprepared financially for retirement. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for the children of a parent who's just not prepared?
So basically, she's not financially prepared to retire, but she wants to retire. Is that?
No, I mean, she has done the calculation and believes she can continue to live once she's retired on her Social Security, but has nothing saved for medical, everything that you talk about.
So I think probably the best thing to do is, as opposed to just the children talking to her, would it make sense for her to go to somebody, an advisor, to lay out the math and say, this is what you're going to get from Medicare, this is what you're going to get from Social Security, this is kind of your discretionary income, and so you have to be prepared for this kind of life. You know, it may be that...
She's done that.
What's that?
She's done that.
Okay, so she knows. Well, and I think, and so I don't know.
Well, I think the other. So when we look at you talked about the trade-offs earlier between your own retirement and your kids, right? When you add parents who need money to that equation, the parents are the thing you can't say no to, right? You can delay your own retirement. You can take out a loan for college. If your parent has a need, that is a really, really difficult thing to turn your back on. And so I think from the perspective of you and your siblings, it's more a matter of gathering together and trying to figure out when she needs help, where is that help going to come from? And how can you prepare, even if she doesn't understand right now that she may need help, you can see it coming. And how can you prepare as a team to step in and help when it becomes really, really clear that that's exactly what you're going to have to do?
That's great advice. Because, yeah, it's the how much do I put away for myself and how much do I give her? So, okay.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hi. My question is around knowing what type of investments to make for women who are on the move in their career. Me personally, I've moved a lot. I move often. And so every time I go to a new place, I find that I'm afraid to make a financial investment or commitment, because if I move countries, if I move, like, what I have to think about future tax impact, penalties. And so I'm so afraid to invest for that reason. But I want to keep on moving, and I like to move, and I do it for my career. So how do I make those decisions that I'm in this country today, I may be in a different one tomorrow?
You're not talking about real estate, right? You're talking about putting money in the market.
Yeah. Or even, like, you know, for example, for 401k, I had to do a lot of thinking around how much to put in, because when I move a country, it will still be available to me. But, you know, there's extra tax and international laws about penalties that I might have to pay more than the average person in terms of taking it out. So what are the best type of investments to make when you want to, as a woman on your move, you want to move? But
so most 401k plans allow you to keep it there even after you leave. Now, a lot of people take it with them just to simplify their life so they don't have 401k plans all over the place. But most times it's an option to just leave it there so you don't have to take the penalties. The worst thing to do is cash out. You can roll your 401k to the next employer, but if you actually take the money out and put it into your brokerage account, that's the worst move because it has the biggest penalties. Don't do that. And so you can always leave it in the plan. If you're moving from employer to employer in the U.S., you can roll them over. But I think also in terms of, let's say you have a brokerage account and an IRA in the U.S. in addition to your 401k, and you move to the U.K. or some other country, you will take that money out. Well, you'd have to close down that account based on some of the international rules. But then you can just invest the money into the version of an IRA in that other country. But never be afraid to invest in the 401k.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
My question is about how are you educating your children, knowing the lessons that you've learned about elderly parents, about how you want them to care for you?
Yeah.
That's a really good one.
So two parts to that question. One is how do you get your kids to be more financially literate so that we don't repeat the same sins over and over? And so we've had, you know, with my son, we've had conversations since he was a little bit younger. And we've actually, we have the 529 and all that, but we actually take some money and invest in things that are of interest to him. And then he can watch how the stock does. And he's not like a stock jockey. He doesn't do it all the time. But, you know, Nike or, you know. So just getting him to understand the concept. So we've done that. It's interesting on the elderly thing. I will tell you that my mom used to live with us before I moved up to Boston. We still go and visit her at least every other weekend in Connecticut. And he comes, she doesn't really know his name anymore, but he comes. And he doesn't always love to come, but he comes. And it's important, you know, I view it as a privilege to take care of somebody that did a heck of a lot for me over the course of my lifetime, and I want to make sure he understands it's a privilege, not a burden, too. And that's more about the empathy than any financial thing. I think that's got to be part of the equation. I don't know if that really answers your question, but...
I think that is a huge, huge part of it. And the other part is being a little transparent about what's going on between you and your parent and allowing them into that dialogue. So my kids are 24 and 21. My mom is 77. I'm, you know, very lucky that she's healthy, but she's had some stuff. And we'll talk about what happens, what does she want. And my kids have been part of that conversation. They know that my mother has said very, very strongly that she does not want to go into any sort of a facility, that she would prefer to give me money and have me add on to my house wherever I happen to live at that time. And they, you know, they joke about, you know, are you going to do that with us? I think they're hoping not. But so I think just allowing them to participate in some of those conversations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi, great to be here. I've received conflicting advice on this, so would love your input. Scenario is sort of, you know, as general as possible for the whole group. Marriage. To combine finances or not to combine. I've heard both ends of the spectrum, and we're trying to figure it out.
So I think that's a very personal choice, and a lot depends on where you are at your life stage, et cetera. I will tell you, so before we get to whether you should or not, let's go to sort of fast forward. We did some research a couple years ago to, you know, are couples ready for retirement? Not even financially, but other... We found the vast majority of couples in their 50s and 60s have never talked about when they're going to retire, where they're going to live in retirement, if they're going to work part-time or not. And so having conversations about what we want out of this and how much control, like how different are your interests? How important is it for you to maintain some control for whatever reason? I think that, if you're like I was when I got married, neither one of us had a thing. No one, you know, there was no sense of, you know, at the time it's like I would never even thought about a prenup or anything like that, you know, or separate accounts. When you actually, if you're in a second marriage, there's a lot of history. There's a lot that comes with that. So, you know, you probably have some specific...
I mean, we did exactly... My first marriage, we combined everything. Yeah. And my second marriage, we have moved a little more slowly. and we've got I've got an account, he's got an account, we've got an account together. Yeah. I do think what Kathy says is absolutely right. If you have a very strong personal preference that you want autonomy... I believe you should have some autonomy.
Yeah.
Because without autonomy, without knowing that there is a pool of money under your control, the likelihood that you are not going to manage it goes way up, and that gets very, very dangerous, particularly for women. But if you feel, for whatever reason, that you don't want to combine everything, then
don't.
Right? And if you feel, for whatever reason, that you do, it's interesting. As we, when I got married for the second time, my husband's kids were in college, so his expenses were like off the charts, and mine weren't there yet. So my expenses were much more moderate. Now my expenses are off the charts, and his are much more moderate. And I think that when we get to a place where we're both more moderate, we may actually combine stuff.
So, and, you know, objectively, if you take the emotion out, objectively, there's probably more downside to combining than not combining, objectively. Emotionally, it's a very different thing, right? But we were talking before, I've shared this with Jean. I was at another one of these kinds of sessions. A woman waited for me afterwards, and she was in her late 30s, early 40s, three little boys. Her husband came home one day, said he wanted a divorce, totally blindsided her, right? He did the investing, she took care of the kids and paid the bills, and she found out in the process of the divorce that he had not actually invested anything. He spent all the money, and she didn't know it. And so now she was had full custody of three kids, didn't have a job, and had to start over. And so that may be a, you know, support for keeping things a little separate.
Just saying. Good luck with that.
Sure.
Here you go.
Hi. My question is around renting versus buying property. To me, it always feels like it's kind of a waste to rent. But if you have the means to buy a property, are there times where it's still better to rent versus purchase?
So, a lot depends on how you feel about the market environment. So we sit here in Boston, pretty hot market right now. Go ahead.
No, if you're going to move anytime within the next 5 years, I would say don't buy.
Right.
A lot of it is just there's a cost to the transaction, and generally that tends to be the dividing line.
Got it. And in general, how much should you be saving? You know, if you purchase, how much you could keep in savings?
If
you're purchasing, you have X amount that has to go to the down payment. In general, is there kind of a rule of thumb to much to keep in savings?
You want to make sure that you've got a good emergency cushion left in savings, because once you own a house, you're going to need that. 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses at a minimum.
And put as much as you can on the down payment, because the interest is brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's better now than it's been in years past, but it still adds up.
Okay. All right.
Thank
we have
you.
Time for one more question. I'll take it from here.
Thank you. I have.
Before everybody, I'm seeing people are running to the next session. Let me just tell you, if you text demand more, one word, DEMANDMORE, to the number 343-898. We've put together some information about all the kind of stuff that we've been talking about here, making the most of your savings and your investments. And so it's demand more, one word, to 343-898. And while you're at it, one more shout out to subscribe to the Her Money podcast. And now we'll take the last question.
I just subscribed, by the way.
Awesome. But, thank you.
I do have a question. I have a special needs child, and me and my husband have really been struggling with how best to... Do we put it into a 529 hoping that they may go to school? I know that there are ABLE accounts now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you do some sort of trust? How best to make that money grow?
Yeah, a lot depends on your specific circumstances, but I think Massachusetts did a really good thing with the ABLE accounts.
Yeah.
I would start there to say, does that fit your needs? And then branch out from there based on some specific considerations, in terms of the amount of money and your child's specific situation.
Okay.
But the ABLE account in general is a very good thing.
Okay. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Thank you, right. Kathy, and thank you so much for coming.
Great job, Gene. Kathy, thank you so much.